at 77, Heritage Mutual Insurance Company versus William E. Larson. Appearing for Heritage Mutual is Attorney Richard Muller. Is it Muller or Miller?
Miller.
You may proceed, counsel.
My name is Richard Miller, and I represent the petitioners in this case, members of the court, and I think this is a very important statewide case, members of the court, because this is the only case that I'm aware of, and Mr. Sobota is aware of, that made the front pages, the headlines of the front pages of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
That is a very interesting fact situation.
Yes, and it was also the subject of media discussion, countless media, and because of the facts in the case.
I would have thought CBS far outweighed it.
So, Your Honors, I want to cut to the chase, if I can. We lawyers and judges here are oftentimes traveling employees. We're required to go to bar conventions. I'm required this morning to appear. My office is in downtown Milwaukee. I have to come here for oral argument in Madison. Now, let's say this morning, and I can tell you this is the first time I've had an oral argument before the Supreme Court, I was kind of nervous. Let's say I left home in Wauwatosa this morning at 7:30, 7 o'clock, and I stopped off on Highway 26 at Johnson Creek. And there's a bar or tavern or there, and I needed to have a couple of drinks to calm my nerves because I was fearful of how I might be interrogated at this oral argument this morning.
We won't ask any questions, did you?
So you can see where my hypothetical is going, Your Honor. Let's say I have too much to drink, lightheaded, and this particular accident, the Larson accident, happened almost 5 years ago to the day, January 31, 1986. Today's January 31, 2001. Let's assume that I have a few drinks, maybe whiskey and Diet Cokes. Feel lightheaded, leave the tavern, and my car is parked out in the parking lot, and I'm lightheaded, didn't have much to eat this morning because I was nervous.
Did you take two diet pills?
And I assume maybe I did, maybe I didn't. And so I'm walking to my car, feel lightheaded, and I pass out. The doctors that examine me after this incident happened take a recorded history, take a physical examination, and conclude that I, as a result of my alcoholic consumption, passed out. Am I entitled to workers' compensation benefits or not? That's the question. I've looked at the CBS case, I've looked at the Wisconsin Electric case. I had the opportunity to listen to the oral argument last night because I was very interested in what was on the court's mind.
What if you passed out on your way into this courtroom?
I'm not sure, Your Honor, that we should look at these cases in terms of a geographical target. The triggering event here is that I passed out because of my own personal conduct. That's the trigger. In other words, the Court of Appeals on this case seemed to get hung up, I think, that, yeah, there was drinking and passing out, but it didn't happen until Mr. Larson was entering this mobile home up in Tigerton, Wisconsin. I think the Court of Appeals has it wrong.
But the statute specifically takes into account the fact that you might be intoxicated and calls for a reduction of 15%. You're asking us for a reduction of 100%.
I'm asking that, Your Honor, because we're talking about the traveling employee statute, and there is compensation for acts that are incidental or reasonable to those in the travel of their work. This particular claimant, Mr. Larson, took himself out of that purview when he consumed alcohol and passed out. And the medical proof is uncontroverted. I mean, the medical records are in the file. They're part of the record here. The examining physician said this man passed out as a result of alcoholic abuse. That's the only medical information we have in the evidence of the record. But in CBS...
How can we ignore the statute that says 15%?
The 15%, Your Honor, is let me give you this example, is that intoxication standing alone, if I go to work and I'm operating machinery and I'm lightheaded and I put my hand in the machine and do the dumbest thing in the world, you're penalized for a 15% reduction. I haven't moved out of the deviation of my employment or put myself outside the scope of the traveling employment, traveling employee situation.
Let me make sure I understand your argument, because I understand the PR.
Right.
I understand that completely. I can read newspapers too. I want to understand your legal argument. Are you arguing that it wasn't in the course of employment, or are you arguing that it is in those line of cases, or is your attack arising under in those lines of cases?
Outside of employment, a deviation outside of the employment situation.
Okay.
We wouldn't be here today. I wouldn't be standing at this podium today, Your Honors, unless this man passed out. It's not the cold weather. It was his actions or conduct personal to him. That's why we're here today.
What do you do with the long line of cases? This employee isn't the first time that there was an employee in the state of Wisconsin that happened to drink, and that was a traveling employee. What do you do with the long line of cases that deal with, first of all, the issue of deviation, and secondly, and I guess more specifically, those who are drunk, traveling, deviation cases. The City of Phillips case, the Nutrine Candy case. What do you do with that case?
Judge, you're going to have to fill me in a little bit on what page of the brief.
The Nutrien Candy case is kind of interesting, and all of these are fact-dependent.
Right.
You have three guys that are going from Milwaukee. They have to go to a seminar in Minneapolis. Okay, so they start out early in the morning, and they first stop at in Boston and drink all morning. And one of them decides maybe I'll take the train to Minneapolis and leaves the other two. Then they stop at Toma for the afternoon. Not to be undaunted, they go up to Menominee, and they drink a little bit more. I mean, they are just totally, whole day of drinking. And on the way from Menominee to Minneapolis, because they're on the right path, you can follow that, you know.
And follow them.
You follow it, you know where they're going. And in fact, that the court there said, it is apparent that the legislature, referring to the 1911 and 1913, when the predecessor statute to which Justice Babbage refers, the 15% penalty for intoxication, the court in Nutrien Candy says, it's apparent that the legislature has deliberately discarded willful misconduct as a criterion, together with all the fictions and constructions attaching to the concept of gross negligence. Whether it's negligence and who's at fault and who's reprehensible conduct has nothing to do with it. The wisdom of a policy which permits drunken employees to recover even a diminished compensation where the intoxication causes injury may be arguable as an original proposition. That is, if you were around here in 1911, you might have been okay. But, after all, this is a matter in which the legislature's intention is clear and the legislative power is plenary. And then they concluded that they were in the course of their employment and compensation was funded. How do you get around that kind of language?
Judge, what's the year of that case? Do you have
it's a 1943 case.
Okay, but I think that I'm not sure if the traveling employee statute was fully in place when that case was decided, Your Honor, because the statute is very clear. Compensation is to be deemed appropriate for acts incidental to the traveling employee status. Now, you can't get around it. That drinking that occurred on that trip that you just described in that case has nothing to do with the employment situation. The trick, nothing to do with it. Absolutely not.
But they still, see, the traveling employee it still has the concepts of course of conduct and arising out under. And this case dealt with course of employment, in terms of the deviation. That's what you're dealing with.
Absolutely.
And they said, hey, it's compensable. If you want to change it, maybe it's not a good idea. Maybe this is a bad idea. But the case discusses the 1911 legislation and the 1913 legislation and says that's the place it should have been changed.
I think the traveling employee statute came into place somewhere in the 40s after that legislation you're just referring to, Your Honor. The bottom line is that the court said in the CBS case and said most recently in the Wisconsin Electric case is that the court has to make a value judgment when reviewing the administrative agency that's charged with making the findings of fact.
Okay, counsel, then looking at 102.03, particularly in F, we talk about the exception, except when engaged in a deviation for a personal or private purpose. Just in this case, Larson went to the tavern, he had four or five...
he said in his testimony, Your Honor, but maybe 6 to 8 and passed out according to what he... I like to think that the examining physicians probably have a more accurate picture.
As a trial judge of 14 years, I always took a couple of drinks as meaning maybe a couple more. But the point is, Justice Savage alluded to this, on this deviation, was it... Now, he deviated... And then he was going to his mobile home, which was served as an office, and he went up the steps, and now, what was this total deviation? Wasn't he back? This is what the Court of Appeals, he opened up the door and then he passed out. Was this an ongoing deviation at all times?
Well, this was anything related to his drunken state.
So
puts him in... First of all, Your Honor, I'm not satisfied that the deviation was clearly over, because if you review the facts of the case, remember, he left town, and his first stop was, he said he was going to go on a diet that I think lasted a few hours, but he stopped to get some corn to feed the deer, and stopped to buy a bottle of Kessler whiskey and a couple of cheese pizzas. And he said I believe there was testimony in the record he was going to revisit the whiskey bar when he got back to the mobile home. So I'm not at all persuaded that the deviation would end. But even if you argue that there's some end of deviation, I don't. Let me put it this way: he's still in a deviation state, Your Honor. I believe because his conduct, okay, the passing out, is so solely personal to him. In other words,
you're saying that because he drank the four or five whiskey and coke or whatever it was,
right?
That was it. That was the deviation, and it continued.
Let me say this. Let's suppose he had six or eight drinks in his kitchen table, never went to the tavern, and went outdoors for some reason, and passed out. I don't believe the situation would be any different than what we're being talked, what's being discussed this morning.
Yeah, maybe it might be because, and we, if you listen to our tape on CBS, I think this was on, will be on it. We are faced with a statute that is has a, for lack of a better phrase, an inherent conflict in it, and that's what makes it so hard, I think, to apply it. Because first it says, at all times while on a trip, you're in the course of employment. Okay, because it's deemed to be growing out of and incidental to the employee's employment at all times. Then you've got a presumption here. Then it says, except when engaged in a deviation for a private or personal purpose. So he's on the trip and he deviates to go to the Dells and engage in water sports. So that looks private or personal. Or you engaged in going to McDonald's for engaging in their little activities in their park for children. But then it says, acts reasonably necessary for living or incidental thereto shall not be regarded as a deviation. So if he was sitting at his table eating and drinking, he's eating his two pizzas, his frozen pizzas, and drinking. Well, eating is necessary for living, so I think that might make it a change.
Well, you know, but if he drinks to an excess and passes out, that has absolutely nothing to do with an act incidental to living. I mean, you're called upon to make a value judgment here, Your Honor, and how can one with a straight face say that someone who drinks to the excess and then passes out is somehow engaged, and I'll put the statute, in an act reasonably necessary for a living or incidental thereto, you know, it just doesn't make common sense.
No, but one of the, then you would divide it out as if he stays conscious but can't pick himself up off the floor. Does that make a difference in your fat situation?
Not if he's on the floor because he's drunk and can't, and passed out because of that condition.
Well, you see, that makes perfectly good sense to me, what you're arguing. It just absolutely perfectly good sense. I mean, if I were in the legislature and drafting a statute, I would draft a statute that if you had any intoxicating liquors, any, below 0.1 or 0.8, any, regardless of where you are, what you're doing, and however it's related to employment, you are out of workers' comp.
And I'm not suggesting that that's, I mean, Judge, you can have a beer after work, or you can have, if you have a glass of wine when you eat, but when you reach the stage of passing out, then you've crossed the bridge.
Well, that's why I gave you my example where you're conscious and you haven't passed out, just you can't manipulate the door, you can't get inside, you can't stand up. So you're going to draft it that way. And I would draft that statute. I might even agree with you and draft a more lenient statute towards drinking. But the legislature apparently has not drafted that because they've apparently recognized intoxication, and as Justice Babbage said, they don't discount it at 100% as you're trying to do. They discount it at 15% if it's causal. And in this case, they didn't even knock it down the 15%.
No. LURC, the administrative agency.
Yes, I know, but ultimately.
Right. And Mr. Swoboda has kind of flip-flopped on his positions in the course of this judicial appeal because he filed papers at the trial court level saying that certainly there's findings of intoxication and they should not be disturbed. And then on the next level of appeal, Mr. Swoboda, I guess, was silent on that. And frankly, members of the court here, you said it. That you have to exercise a value judgment, and if Mr. Swoboda, all I
only if the legislature has not exercised it for us.
Well, Your Honor, I don't.
What case are you
in? Well, in the CBS case, Your Honor, I want to quote this exactly, the opinion of this court. Determination of a deviation for a private or personal purpose of acts reasonably necessary or living or incidental thereto call for a value judgment and judicial review of that value judgment. That's what you folks have to decide to do.
Okay, well, let's look at that CBS case. And one of the holdings of the CBS case is that you owe great weight deference. Is that correct? Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
Let me pull another one of the litany of traveling salesman drunk cases, because as I said, there's a long line of them. Let's give you a little more recent one. City of Phillips. That's a case where the chief of police was going to another town, I think, to a seminar. Anyway, drinks all day, drinks all night, staying in a motel. 2:30 in the morning, I mean, after he's been in this bar and that bar and everything. 2:30 in the morning. In fact, he is going in a way that would look to be a contrary way from the bar or restaurant to his motel. But LURC says, and by the way, he has, you know, we're not talking about under a point, you know, 0.10 or 0.10. 0.24, 0.024. I mean, that's
pretty bad.
A little drunk. And that's where the injury is sustained. And Lurk finds that it's compensable. And the Supreme Court, in reviewing that, says, look, you know, this could go either way. But we owe, essentially, says, we owe great weight deference. I'm putting those words in because that came in CBS, but essentially says this is a close case. The department could have found either way, but we might have even gone a different way, but we defer to the department. And in that case, the court said, after saying their facts could go either way, this court has pointedly refrained from ruling as a matter of law that intoxication is synonymous with personal deviation. It isn't. Your argument seems to be that intoxication is synonymous with personal deviation. How do you get around that statement? How do you get around, again, this litany of cases?
First of all, there's been a definite shift in the court's view of the findings of fact made by Lurk. I mean, this court said in the CBS case, Your Honor, that we're called upon to make a value judgment as to whether or not what Lurk did is reasonable. And giving them due deference, as you indicate, you're right. But, Mike, how can you? And with
that's,
these sets of...
Not due deference, great weight.
Great weight. And giving that great weight and looking at the conduct of Mr. Larson who passes out, how can this court deem that conduct to be reasonable? Because when you apply the value judgment standard, how can you tell the community, this state, that conduct, or Lurk's determination of Larson's conduct, is reasonable?
Let me see if I understand your position by a couple of questions here.
Sure.
I assume that had there been no breaking involved, and had he gone up there for the arrow, and he walked in or tried to get into his trailer park and somehow his mobile home and somehow got injured in doing so, we wouldn't be here because he was going into, assuming that it's a business purpose.
Assuming that, but just as you'll note in the brief, Your Honor, we have not conceded that that was a business trip for all the reasons discussed. I won't.
I understand, but assume that it's a business trip and he injures himself.
Gotcha.
That's okay, right? Because he's going into his trailer to go to sleep for the night.
Yeah, absolutely. He's got to have a pillow for his head. He's got to have to eat. He's got to go to the toilet.
Right.
He's got to make a phone call. If he trips over his kitchen chair to get to the fax machine, absolutely.
I understand. Now let me add another fact to this. Now let's assume that he has had four drinks, but he doesn't pass out. And he injures himself trying to get into his trailer. He can't get in, can't get that key to work because it was off his wife's old. He had to have a duplicate key made, so he punches a hole into the window or something to get in because it's awfully cold outside. And he really does severe damage to his hand. Is that compensable, assuming that he's up there for a business trip?
I don't know because I don't know if there's enough. Each case has to be judged on its own facts.
Yeah, judge the facts.
Judge, but what's the medical proof? Is the medical proof that his intoxication?
There's no medical proof other than the admission that he had four or five drinks and the doctor says he was intoxicated.
Not compensable.
Non-compensable. So you would ignore the statute.
I'm not ignoring
the statute that says 15% deduction for intoxication.
I'm not ignoring the statute. That statute, Judge, only deals with workers in the course of employment who do a dumb thing, put their hand in the machine because they're lightheaded or intoxicated.
That's the case I'm giving you.
He's taken himself out of the employment situation, Judge, when he's drank the alcohol. You have to distinguish whether you're...
Your argument still is if you drink alcohol, you are not within the course of employment. That's your argument.
You drink alcohol and pass out like Mr. Larson did, Your Honor. That's what I'm contending.
Okay. Well, I just want to make sure I understand. Right. So if you drink... I'm not pointing. I just do.
No, I have secrets.
If you drink 4 to 5 drinks a day, and if you're an alcoholic, and you can function, and no one would know that you're drinking 4 or 5 drinks a day. Your system is so acclimated to it. Does that, I want to find where your limit is now. Now, is, do you have to pass out? Is that your limit?
See, Your Honor, see, what you're trying to get me to concede is that there's a bright line rule, and I don't think there's a bright line rule on these cases. In other words, but certainly in the case, because each case, as the court said many times, has to be evaluated on its own facts.
Well, we are here to, you know, we've got a, if we don't have any bright line rule with regard to what constitutes a deviation and whether, you know, if you're going to say, oh, it depends on each individual facts, then why don't we just close the book and say, great rate deference?
Because you can't, because that would be abrogating your responsibility. So, yeah,
there are no bright lines. We just decided on a case-by-case basis.
No, there are rules of law that apply, Judge, but each fact, the fact situations are different, and that has to be taken into account. But to get back to your question, Your Honor, the triggering question is, did this potential worker's intoxication cause the injury? Such that it takes him out of the workplace. And I guess my light is on.
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Okay. Thanks, Judge.
I next have Stephen Sabota, Attorney Sabota, representing Lurk for 15 minutes, and then Attorney Ward representing Mr. Larson for 15 minutes. No, it doesn't make any difference to me. I'm good. No problem.
Thank you. Members of the court, my name is Bob Ward, and on behalf of Mr. Larson, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to come and talk to you about this interesting case. I'm a workers' compensation lawyer, and I've been practicing workers' compensation law pretty much exclusively for a little over 18 years. As a result, I frequently am faced with the opportunity to explain to either clients or even other lawyers the circumstances under which a person may be entitled to receive workers' compensation benefits or the types of benefits that are available under the Workers' Compensation Act. And when I do that, almost invariably, a sort of puzzled or quizzical look comes across the face of the person that I'm speaking with. And I've learned over the course of time that that quizzical look is really a reflection of a disconnection between what the average person might think is fair and just in a particular application and the actual workings of the Workers' Compensation Act. And I think that that disconnection may be fueling some of the public's interest in this particular case. I can tell you that there's no shortage of people that are very surprised to learn that a person can recover workers' compensation benefits notwithstanding the fact that the injury was caused by intoxication. And there's no shortage of people, reasonable people, maybe even people in this room, that think that the law shouldn't be that way. But as Justice Bradley pointed out, Justice Wickham in the Nutrien Candy case stated that the wisdom of a policy which permits drunken employees to recover even a diminished compensation where intoxication causes injury may be arguable as an original proposition. Of course it's arguable. I would imagine that there was quite an argument in the legislature back in 1913 when this statute, I believe, was originally passed. It's interesting, reference to the case of Gimbel Brothers versus the Industrial Commission would suggest that the precursor of Wisconsin Statute 10258 actually was passed specifically in response to a decision in Nakusa Edwards Paper Company versus the Industrial Commission at 154 WIS 105, also a 1913 case. And in the Nakusa Paper case, benefits were paid to a man who was intoxicated and fell off his horse wagon and sustained injury. and there was no intoxication statute in effect at that time. At the very next legislative session, the legislature passed what is now Wisconsin Statute 10258, and they did not decide, as Chief Justice Abrahamson might do if she was in the legislature, that we're going to deny benefits totally to the person who sustains injury as the result of intoxication. Faced with this fact situation, they decided they were going to enact a statute which provided for a 15% reduction in the event proof was made that the injury was caused by intoxication.
Mr. Ward?
Yes.
In the Gorenson case, we found that there was a deviation, even though you had a traveling employee. How is this case different than the Gorenson case, in your opinion?
I don't believe that Gorenson was an intoxication case at all. I think that this court decided that although there was drinking involved, my understanding of the Gorenson case is that Mr. Gorenson sustained injury when he leapt from a window ledge. There was information in the facts of the case that would suggest that he was fleeing a violent situation that may have been of his own making. He had apparently invited a woman into his room. There, Mr. Gorenson, I'm sorry.
Aren't the facts that there was drinking going on throughout the course of the evening as far as Mr. Gorenson was concerned?
I think that that's fair. I think that there is information in the case that would suggest that Mr. Gorenson had been drinking through the course of the day. But I don't think that the court in Gorenson focused on the drinking. Rather, the court focused on the fact that the injury arose out of a force purely personal to him, the fact that he had somehow invited someone into his room, that somehow a situation developed that caused him to choose to jump out of the window rather than stay in the room. And I think an important distinction in Gorenson is that Mr. Gorenson did not have a specific statute to protect him in his instance. Mr. Larson has a specific statute that protects him, that being Wisconsin Statute 10258. If we were to apply the Gorenson analysis to Mr. Larson's situation, then intoxication alone is sufficient to support the idea that the injury does not arise out of the employment, in which case we would be giving a traveling employee less protection than the average employee under the Workers' Compensation Act. The position urged by Mr. Miller, in fact, would result in a traveling employee not being protected if his injuries are caused by intoxication, whereas the average employee is. And reference to the traveling employee statute clearly indicates that the legislative intent was to expand the protection for a traveling employee, not shrink it.
Well, when we talked about value judgments and reasonableness in CBS, we talked about it again in WEPCO. Don't we have to bring that into play as well in this type of situation? Don't we have to make a value judgment? Don't we have to look at the reasonableness of the entire situation?
As I read Justice Geske's opinion in CBS, she quoted the Nadelson case in talking about the value judgment. That is the language in the case that talks about a value judgment. And as I understood it, that language suggests that the value judgment is to be made by the Labor and Industry Review Commission. And the great weight deference standard that is to be applied is in recognition of the fact that the Labor and Industry Review Commission brings its value judgment to bear on the particular fact situation. And because of their expertise and their experience and all the reasons in the four-factor test, that's why great weight deference is applicable. I don't believe that the CBS case calls on this court to exercise its value judgment. I think it is a recognition of the fact that the LERC applied its value judgment, and as a result of its experience and expertise, great weight deference is appropriate. That's how I think value judgment fits into the current situation.
Well, Can I just finish?
Sure.
Given the great weight deference approach that we should be taking, how do we get around the determination by LERC in regard to the 15% reduction? Obviously, the trial court found differently, and so did the Court of Appeals.
I think even applying a great weight deference standard, and I'm not sure, as I stand here, whether it would be appropriate to classify the issue as to whether or not the intoxication caused the injury is a conclusion of law or a finding of fact. And I have to admit that I'm often confused as to what is what.
So is this court.
But in any event, I think that the standard of review is very similar, and that is whether or not there's a rational basis for the conclusion. I think that if we apply great weight deference, my understanding is that we're supposed to examine this to see whether or not there's a rational basis. In regard to the 15% reduction, it's interesting to note that the Labor and Industry Review Commission did not make the finding that Mr. Miller urges, and that is that Mr. Larson lost consciousness as a result of the intoxication. Reference to the LERC decision indicates that at page 6 of their decision, which I think is page 285 in the appellate record, states that the applicant's drinking may or may not have contributed to his syncopal episode. The finding that they made was that the ingestion of alcohol contributed to Mr. Larson remaining asleep for a long enough period of time for the frostbite to occur. And the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals, and I guess I agree, indicated that there isn't any evidentiary support in the record for that specific finding. Now, is there evidentiary support in the record for a conclusion that Mr. Larson lost consciousness as a result of alcohol intake? There is evidentiary support for that. But the LERC did not make that finding. They said it may have, it may not have. The finding that they made was that the ingestion of alcohol allowed him to remain asleep long enough for the injury to occur, and the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals, and I believe, that that finding requires evidence, and there is no evidence in the record that would support that.
Could I ask you a question? If you were writing on this subject as a member of the court, would intoxication ever amount to a deviation?
I don't believe that a plain reading of the statute would allow for that type of conclusion. I think if you look at the statute, it doesn't include any sort of exceptions. It doesn't say unless the intoxication evinces a wanton and willful ignorance of the business interest. It doesn't have any exceptions. It is very clear and simple. It says, under these circumstances, the appropriate remedy is to reduce the benefit by 15%. Also, if you look at the case law through the years, you know, this court has had the opportunity to examine some pretty unusual fact situations, as Justice Bradley pointed out. And in those cases that have been affirmed, obviously the legislature has not looked at those cases and come back and said, whoa, you're going too far here. They haven't taken any steps to say, this is not what we meant. So I think that the legislative intent wouldn't allow for this court to conclude that intoxication constitutes a deviation.
Well,
I'm sorry.
Mr. Ward, are you finished answering Justice Prosser?
I am, sir.
You are an expert in workers' comp. Have you examined or been privy to any knowledge that this subject has even has come up when labor and management get together every 2 years to come up with their, quote, agreed-upon bill that they submit to the legislature in this area?
No, I haven't heard that. But I did note, and Mr. Miller made note of the article in the paper that was about this, and they had a quote from me, and maybe they got it right. And they also had a quote from, I think, a director of the Wisconsin Association of Manufacturers and Commerce. And there was a quote talking about an effort to get a legislative change in response to 10258. And as this court is aware, that is an opportunity that's available through the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council. I'm not aware as to whether or not that effort is afoot.
Was your answer to Justice Prosser in essence saying that with respect to intoxication, all value judgments have been taken away from this court?
By the legislature?
Yeah.
Yes.
Could I ask, I think I'm meshing this with Justice Babich. If we were talking about controlled substances, someone's being influenced by controlled substances rather than intoxicating liquors, would the result be different?
I don't think so. I think that the statute also deals with controlled substances as well. 10258 also, I think, deals with controlled substances as well. So I think my answer would be the same.
Hopefully you're right. Yes, sure, sure.
You referred to Section 10258 as providing protection for employees, and I'm not clear on your argument about that. I read it as providing only for a reduction in the amount of the award where proof of intoxication as the cause of the injury is present.
I guess what I mean about protection is it is clearly an area in which the legislature has spoken as to how to deal with the issue of intoxication causing injury.
But the statute doesn't say don't consider intoxication, or intoxication doesn't constitute a deviation, or intoxication does not preclude recovery. It doesn't say anything like that. There may be circumstances under which, therefore, it would. It just says that where there is sufficient proof that intoxication caused the injury, you reduce the award by 15%.
I guess in part my reliance is not only on the language of the statute, but the case law interpreting that statute. I think that you can trace through the cases, nothing's coming to mind right off the top of my head, but pretty much all the cases indicate that intoxication alone is not sufficient to establish a deviation. I think the City of Phillips case says that. I think the Dibble case says that. And I also think that the Nutrien Candy case says that.
And there's some evidence that the statute was a legislative response to that?
The Gimbel Brothers case that I cited was, in it is contained language that suggests that 10258, and I would imagine that it didn't have that number back in 1913 because I don't think we had that many statutory sections. But in the Gimbel Brothers case, there is a suggestion through the legislative history that's also in the Nutrien Candy case that suggests that that legislation was passed directly in response to the Nakusa paper case, wherein there, in a split decision, this court in 1913 awarded benefits to a person that was intoxicated and fell off his hay wagon. And in the next legislative session, the legislature addressed this issue. And the suggestion is that this was a legislative response. Now, I haven't done any sort of legislative history research, so I can't say that. I can only say what the cases say in that regard.
I'm going to focus on what... Never mind, I'll say.
Would you like to continue?
No, I'll save it for Mr.
Sabota. I see that my time is up, and I thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Ward. Mr. Sabota, you have something to look forward to.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Stephen M. Sabota, Assistant Attorney General, and I represent the Commission in this appeal. Appreciating the lateness of the hour, Your Honors, I have just a couple of really quick points that I want to make, and then obviously I would like to answer any specific questions the court has of me. Number one, the Goranson case was my case in the Supreme Court. It's important to remember that in the Goranson case, that case was decided, it was a denial not on the course of employment issue, it was a denial on the arising out of issue. Goranson was found to be in the scope of his employment when he drove the people to Green Bay for the Packer game. He lost under the positional risk analysis because the court basically thought that he, in effect, courted the situation he was in by having a woman in his hotel room in Green Bay.
And counsel, then the arising out of is different from the course of employment. Arising out of involves positional risk doctrine. Course of employment involves deviation.
Right.
Goranson, the holding of Goranson is arising out of.
And this court in Goranson, Your Honor, specifically set forth the distinction between those two separate prerequisites for recovery. Right.
I noticed, if I may continue, I noticed in Goranson there's also the reference to Lurk. Isn't Lurk's determination in Goranson was to deny benefits?
Correct.
And then the Goranson case, in giving some kind of deference to Lurk, found consistent with Lurk's determination. Is that correct?
Correct.
Question?
Yes, sir.
Kind of picking up from Justice Sykes' question to your co-counsel as far as 10258 decreased compensation. In the facts of this case, the Lurk, who you're representing here, said, look, there was this drinking, and we infer from that that because of that, I won't get into the whole thing, there was a 15% reduction. Your co-counsel indicates that this is for the protection, the statute is for the protection of the employee. Do you agree with that?
It's for the protection, Your Honor, to the extent that I'm aware that in some states, and I couldn't tell you off the top of my head, intoxication, and although it's a very difficult burden of proof for the employer, can be a complete defense to the workers' compensation claim. So to the extent that in Wisconsin, I think what Mr. Ward is saying, the employee is protected to the extent that the most he can probably lose is 15% of his primary comp.
And here, didn't Lurk infer from the evidence that Larson's intoxication, which caused him to sleep longer, basically caused his injury? And I mean, now that's rejected by the circuit court, and it's rejected by the Court of Appeals, but after just using a greater weight deference standard and looking at the evidence itself, are you indicating to this court that representing Lurk now, that they didn't do enough there, that they should have done more?
Your Honor, what I'm indicating both, and what I hope to indicate to the Court of Appeals and to this court, is that the commission basically, after Judge Malmstead's decision in the circuit court, basically, I think, in effect, confessed error. And we confessed error to the extent that we believe that the questions of intoxication and whether the intoxication caused Larson's injury are pure questions of fact. And the citation that I would like to give you for that proposition is a case called Massachusetts Bonding and Insurance Company versus Industrial Commission. It's 8 Wis 2nd, 606 at 609, 99 Northwest 2nd, 809, a 1959 decision of this court. In recognition of the fact that Judge Malmstead essentially said there was not sufficient evidentiary support for the commission's determination, the commission in effect agreed with that and decided not to argue that issue any further in the Court of Appeals or in this court.
What about the medical record?
I'm sorry?
Over here.
Oh, I'm sorry.
What about the medical records?
The medical record is basically, as Mr. Ward said, there are no quote-unquote medical records that were garnered, obviously, from Mr. Larson while he was being cared for. And what Judge Malmstead, as I understand it, said, I would agree with the Lurk finding that there was enough in those records to say Larson was intoxicated. However, there was not enough in those records to support the second half of the test, which is that the intoxication caused his frostbite injuries.
Isn't that a reasonable inference that the Lurk could have drawn? I'm surprised.
Your Honor, but quite honestly, the commission decided not to push the matter. I know that my learned opponent refers to that as a flip-flop by the commission, but Your Honor, I don't think it is. And the case that I'd like to point out that says that the commission clearly has the authority in certain situations to make determinations, that one of which can be supported by the record and one of which is not supported by the record, the case is M&M Realty Company versus Industrial Commission, 267 Wisconsin 52 at 58, 64 Northwest 2nd, 413, 1954. And I'm quoting from page 58 of the WIS reports, and it says, quote, "It is a necessary corollary of such construction," and that's of 102.23 subsection 1, "that the court may also in its discretion set aside only the part of the order not supported by the evidence and permit to stand the other portion that is sustained by the evidence." I submit that's exactly what Judge Malmstead did in this case. He certainly allowed to stand the award of primary compensation and set aside the commission's 15% reduction as not supported by the record.
Right. I'm not suggesting that the trial court didn't have the authority to kind of slice and dice here.
Right.
I'm suggesting that there perhaps was sufficient evidence when you take into consideration the logical inferences that can be drawn from the evidence by the LERC to support the finding, and so it was an erroneous exercise of the circuit court's authority to overturn that.
Okay.
Not that it didn't have the authority to do so in the first place.
Obviously, Your Honor, if the question you're asking me is, Mr. Sobota, would you like to see the commission's original decision, in effect, reinstated by this court, I don't see how I can argue against my client to that effect, but I want to clearly make it clear to you this morning that we can also live with what Judge Malmstead did, and I don't want to, you know, play cutesy with the court and say, yeah, I want to have my cake and eat it too. What we're here this morning basically asking for is a affirmance of both Judge Malmstead's decision and the Court of Appeals decision, and the commission would be happy with that. But obviously, under the M&M rationale, I understand that this court certainly has some discretion in its view of this case, where two separate determinations are made, one of which is clearly the value judgment or legal conclusion on the primary comp, the other one, which I think is the pure factual question on the 15% decrease comp.
Counsel, you said that you thought intoxication can, at times, be a complete defense, but that it was a tough defense.
I believe that is the rule in some states, Your Honor, by statute, correct.
And what about here, in this
state? Not in this state. It would be, as Professor Larson said, clearly one of the factors that a trier of fact can consider in making a finding of personal deviation, and I think the case that would best exemplify that in Wisconsin would be the Dibble case, 40 West 2nd, where compensation was denied.
And LERC said it was a, quote, substantial factor.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear
that. And LERC said it was a substantial factor, as I recall, in coming to their conclusion.
On the decreased comp, Your Honor, correct, yes. That was the finding that LERC originally made.
And in Dibble, the Supreme Court affirmed the...
a complete denial of compensation on the basis of a personal deviation under the statute, correct.
Should Judge Malmstead have remanded this matter to LERC to allow them to add to the record or to fully explain their decision?
He did not, Your Honor, but I believe that under 102.24 he would have had that discretion, but that was not his mandate to the commission.
Wasn't required to remand.
He was not.
The cat.
The circuit court has wide discretion as to what it can do with the record at that point in time. Thank you very much, Your Honors, for your attention this morning.
Mr. Sobota, we have some questions for you. You only have an orange light on.
Nothing further?
No. Oh. In this remand, the court, I am troubled by, obviously, the fact situation, by the presentation. If this court would simply say, yes, we're going to affirm everything, and because, but we have heard from all counsel here, is there any way, from LERC's standpoint, other than you're asking for an affirmance, that you think this court could handle this case? In other words, if understanding what you know about the case, do you have any recommendations for us? It is not being a heretic to...
Right.
Well, you've already taken two positions as well.
Might as well take another.
Your Honor, can I go so far as to speculate what I think the commission decision was, if you're interested in my speculation? I think it was a compromise decision. And I think what they did when they reversed ALJ Ryan, they looked at this case and said, we feel that under the traveling employee cases in Wisconsin, we have no conclusion to reach but that this man was back in the course of his employment, I think, basically when he left the Split Rock Tavern. And so, therefore, he's covered under 102.03.1F. But we are troubled by the heavy degree of intoxication in this case, and we think that a just and equitable result, and I know there's no such thing as equity in the Workers' Comp Act because it's a statutory creation, they felt that it would be fair to reduce the compensation by 15%. That's only, by the way, the disability part of the award so that the medical expenses are still paid in full. And I think the commission's hope was that would basically satisfy the interest of Mr. Larson, and it would also, to some extent, satisfy the interest of the insurance company. And I believe that the commission thought it was doing the right thing in that regard, and I think their fond hope was that the case would not be appealed to the circuit court. Once it was, all bets were off, because then, of course, Mr. Larson could ask for a cross appeal on the 15% reduction issue, and he won the whole case. So that's my view of it.
That's what happens when you take a middle round, you get hit by both sides.
I know, but as a practical matter, Your Honor, tribunals sometimes do that.
Well, and they do that, which goes back to Mr. Ward's comments. They do that because if you don't know the law, and you're just looking at common sense, you don't see why somebody who drank to excess, took pills, fumbled around and passed out because of his own bad personal behavior ought to recover and be rewarded for conduct that this society does not approve.
Right.
And that's the difficulty, I think, as Mr. Ward said, which was what was facing work and faced all the courts, that you've got a break between common sense and the workers' compensation law.
Could I finish up with one last case citation, which I think is probably the case that really controls this case? That's the famous case of the young man who was urinating off the running board of the truck, the Carlsless case, 243 Wisconsin 612, 11 Northwest 2nd 179, a 1943 decision of this court. And at that time, you know, all comp cases were reviewed in Dane County Circuit Court, so the circuit court judges in Dane County were the experts. In the circuit court decision in that case, which reversed the agency's award of compensation, this is what the Dane County Circuit Court said about the conduct of the claimant. Quote, "There was nothing natural about what he was attempting at all, period. It was the unnatural, unreasonable, preposterous, and silly, in addition to being about criminal. The claimant's injuries were not proximately caused by his attempt to urinate, but that he deliberately placed himself in a place of danger. He courted injury. He should be barred from compensation." This court reversed the Dane County Circuit Court and awarded compensation. I think under that same rationale, Your Honor, this court must award the, at least obviously, the primary compensation to Mr. Larson in this case. And of course, the Carlsless case, that rationale was recently reaffirmed by this court in Breakbush Brothers. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Sabota. Mr. Miller, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thanks, Your Honor. Mr. Sabota, when the electric company case was discussed, in response to a question, said that the employee that goes on the 20-mile sightseeing trip, that's a case, if you give compensation, that pushes the envelope. Well, by gosh, I assume Mr. Sabota was candid in his remarks to the court when he said that this case really breaks open the envelope. Members of the court, I disagree with what Mr. Ward has told you. You are required to make a value judgment in this case. You can't get around it. And you can't tell the people in the state of Wisconsin, utilizing common sense and a rational approach, that intoxication passing out does not constitute a deviation. You can't read that into the traveling employee statute. The traveling employee statute is clear. It says acts incidental, reasonable for living. You've got to make that call, members of the court, and you're going to be sending the wrong message to everybody in the state of Wisconsin because of the intoxication. There's no workers' compensation law in the state of Wisconsin that holds for the proposition that intoxication cannot be regarded as a deviation.
You and your opposing counsels made reference to the notoriety of this case and above the fold, and I don't have the article in front of me, but one of the commissioners in that article was quoted as saying, look, there was a deviation. The deviation, this is loosely quoted, but it's my quote is accurate.
Okay.
There was a deviation, and if the person would have been injured in the bar, there wouldn't have been compensation. But here, the person was at the threshold of the door.
And there was nothing, if I could just say.
Given that perspective, and I'm not saying necessarily that quote now, but that perspective, that even if there was a deviation, the deviation is over with, and now they've resumed. How do you respond to that?
First of all, there's nothing about the dwelling, the structure, the mobile home, the place in Tigerton that was defective or did not allow for heat. I mean, it was well kept. The pipes didn't freeze or anything like that. There's nothing inherent about the structure. The injury happened because of his intoxicated conduct, solely personal to him, Your Honor. That's what happened. In other words, I don't think we should get hung up on geographical. Did he get hurt? Did he pass out in the bar? Did he pass out when he got out of his car on his way to the mobile home? Did he pass out?
The deviation, though, requires two. It isn't just whether a deviation. And you hit on both that seem to be blending them. First of all, you have to say, is there a deviation? Yes or no? There's argument here that there's no longer a deviation. But let's say there is a deviation, and it's only once you have established a deviation, then you get to the next part of the deviation of analysis of whether or not it was for personal purpose, private or personal purposes. But you don't get to the private or personal purposes unless you've established a deviation. That quote I was suggesting indicates that the deviation is over with. No, they're back at the threshold, opening the door for the night's eating and lodging.
No, because the opening of the door or the entrance into that mobile home had nothing to do with his injury. Nothing to do with his injury. The deviation continued because he was feeling the effects of his conduct. What were the effects of his conduct? He passed out. That deviation didn't end. In other words, we don't have a clock on it.
The deviation only comes into play when you're looking at, not at arising out of, but at the course of conduct part of it.
Right.
So that's only when you get into deviation. You can't use deviation in terms of arising out of.
I agree, Your Honor, but I'm just respectfully submitting that the conduct, the personal conduct, the drinking, the passing, was continuing at the time the injury happened. And, Your Honor, I think the Michigan Supreme Court said it well, when you're a traveling employee, you can't cash in your chips and put it in the bank. When you're a traveling employee, bought and drink, page 23 of my brief, an employee who has the right to have his homeward journey covered, so to speak, can't put that in the bank and cash in his chips whenever it suits his fancy. And that's what the Wisconsin Supreme Court, when it denied compensation to a lawyer who had been drinking, past his business constraints.
Could I ask this question?
Yes, just
Section 10258, does that have any different effect on the traveling employee than it has on the ordinary employee?
No, I think it's pretty much the same, Your Honor. I mean, but they're separate and distinct principles. I mean, a traveling employee who in the course of his business does something dumb and is not in a deviation, does something dumb, is subject to the 15% penalty. But that employee who steps out and is in a deviation path, he's not entitled to any compensation, I submit, under the state of the law.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Mr. Ward. Thank you, Mr. Sabota. That concludes our hearing in 98-3577, Heritage Mutual Insurance Company versus William E. Larson.